At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Hello, Beth. It is so nice to have you on the podcast again. How are you doing?
Hey, Hannah. I'm really good. Thank you. I'm very excited to be back. I feel like it's been quite a while since I did the last one.
Yeah. Do you know when the last one was?
I think it must have been a couple of 2 years. Almost 2 years, it must have been.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I, no offence, but can't actually remember when it was.
No,
neither. But I think it was, you know, a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So it's crazy because, I mean, I said this on the podcast the other day, but I've recently been having people back for like a second episode.
Okay.
And it has been people that kind of, you know, came on when I started the podcast or like within a year. And so it's so nice. We're, oh my God, we're still doing this. And like, you're still doing what you're doing. And like, you know, we've both like made changes and things like that. And we both have obviously made big changes.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to like reconnect with people and still be like, oh, we're still doing what we said we were going to do.
Yeah, so true. So true. Lots has changed, but also, you know, lots actually kind of hasn't. Still doing the same kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess just for the listeners, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us about the work that you do?
Yes, sure. So I'm a specialist eating disorders dietitian. And so I've worked in eating disorders for quite a long time in different roles as a dietitian since 2020. And more recently this year, have stepped into the freelance world. So I now run my own private practice, the ED dietitian, and do that full time, seeing clients remotely at the moment for one-to-one dietetic sessions to support them with eating disorders, disordered eating, and everything under that umbrella, really.
And forgive me if I heard that wrong, but did you say that you had worked in eating disorders and then became a dietitian specifically in 2020? So what were you doing before?
Yeah, so I was actually a healthcare assistant in an eating disorders unit for quite some time, 2 years, maybe a bit more, and then I stepped into a dietetic assistant role and then left that to go and qualify as a dietitian. So a little bit backwards to usual. I think most people qualify as a dietitian and then look to specialize in eating disorders, but I kind of did it the other way around, actually.
Yeah, that's funny that you did do it kind of the other way around. I guess, did you kind of know that that was the area that you wanted to work in and then thought, oh, you know, I want to be a dietitian?
Yeah, exactly that. So I did a master's in eating disorders and clinical nutrition first. And then whilst I was doing that master's, realised like eventually I need to qualify as a dietitian to be able to do the work I want to do. But before I went straight into that, took some time out to actually work in the field in those other roles before then qualifying.
Is that the UCL one?
Yeah.
How did I not know that you'd added that?
What? Did you?
Yes.
I didn't know.
What year did you do it?
I must have done it in 2015 to 2016.
I did my undergrad 2016 to 2019, and then I did that master's 2020.
Okay. I had no
idea. I can't believe
you've
never had this conversation before. Yeah. I mean, when you said it, I was like, well, there's definitely not many eating disorder and nutrition masters that you can do. That's so funny.
I literally had no idea. That's hilarious.
Well, that is so lovely that we have just discovered that. I'm sure everyone listening loves so that experience. So we were going to talk about something today that I think is a very difficult thing for people in recovery to go through, and personally it's something that I'm still kind of contending with, which is why I was so keen to get you on to talk about it. But it's the topic of extreme hunger, and personally I have, I guess, thoughts around the term extreme hunger, and if you want to call it that. But I guess let's just start with maybe
you could explain why that happens when someone's recovering from an eating disorder.
Yeah, for sure. I'm glad that you kind of touched on the, I guess, thoughts around the word extreme. Because I quite like to remind clients that, I guess, what was extreme was the restriction and the behaviours that they've kind of subjected their bodies to. And actually the hunger is in response to that. And so it isn't actually extreme when we look at the environment that someone's body's been in. Because I think extreme can kind of create worry and panic and like this idea of it being abnormal. So I think, I mean, I haven't come up with a better term at the moment, but I think extreme can be a little bit problematic. I think there's so many different reasons. Kind of, we've got physical, psychological, so I'm going to kind of cover a few different ones. I think often someone has been ignoring their hunger cues or not giving space to recognize hunger for quite some time. And so because it hasn't been thought about at the time or during restrictive periods, it's hunger's kind of seen as irrelevant because you're not dictating whether you eat in accordance with hunger anyway. And so as that gets actively ignored, when you step into recovery, you start to maybe eat more and increase your intake. It can sometimes feel that hunger is increasing, but actually it can also be a sense of you being more aware of hunger and the sensation not being as muted. And then, you know, physically, there's metabolic changes going through happening as someone goes through recovery and they increase their intake. And, you know, correctly so, our hunger levels increase in order to help someone meet their increasing dietary needs as they go through that process. Quite similarly, I think it can take time for somebody to build up their intake to one that is fully adequate and satisfying. And so when you're in that like in between period where maybe you're eating more than you were before, or you're challenging more rules than you were before, but maybe you're still not actually quite eating enough, that period can feel really difficult, because that's when I think hunger can be at its highest, essentially. You know, on top of that, you've got food rules and, you know, maybe certain foods being avoided, and that creates like, that's like a scarcity mindset and a craving for certain foods, and that can feel really extreme. And it's really important to remember that it's a restriction that's creating that and not greed. I often have conversations with clients who their automatic response to feeling hunger or craving specific foods is that they're greedy. And I think because it feels out of control, or, you know, a client may feel that if they allow themselves to eat that food, they will eat huge amounts of it. In fear of that, they continue to avoid it, and that continues to drive the feeling of being out of control and craving it, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I think hunger, this is something actually a client brought into a group that I did once and I thought was really interesting, that hunger can feel quite different in active restriction versus in recovery. In active restriction, hunger is almost like a safety and like a confirmation that you're doing something right. But when you're in active recovery and you feel hungry, there's more fear and overthinking because it feels like you shouldn't be hungry. And so it feels extreme because suddenly like hunger is like unwanted. You know, you don't want to feel hungry when you're actually maybe eating more. So there's a lot, I think. I think it's a very complicated, you know, as you kind of said in your introduction, it's like there's a lot to talk about. But they're kind of the things that I tend to talk about with clients when we think about kind of extreme hunger and why it might be happening, and kind of challenging the idea of it being something wrong, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that's potentially the scariest part of it, is that, I'm just going to kind of put a blanket statement out there, that most things what I'll talk about today is literally my experience, because it's been so kind of recent. So obviously if people are listening and like, I don't feel that, then I'll just say now that I'm just going to talk about it from my experience. But for me, I think that's been like the hardest thing, is I've gone from eating very little to now eating more, and I'm more hungry. And it's been the same in terms of energy levels and things like that. And when I was restricting, I had so much energy. I could do everything. And then now that I'm eating more, you're like, oh, well, I should have more energy. And, you know, people always say, I want to recover, so I have more energy. And you're like, I'm exhausted all the time. like, what's going on? And I think that's, for me, been the hardest thing mentally to get over, because it's like, how can you possibly be hungry? I'm giving you more food. Because I, and I think you kind of mentioned this in your introduction before, like, I maybe wasn't sensing hunger, mm-hmm. because it was, I was in such a like restricted place that my body was like, well, we're just like, you know, we can't be sending those hunger signals. We've not got the resources or what have you to mm-hmm. do that. You're in that like restrictive state. So I wasn't feeling that hunger. And then now you are feeling that hunger. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how does this make any sense from where I was before?
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like it gets switched on again. And it's mm-hmm. it's, I guess I try and reframe in a sense of, it's not that you weren't feeling hungry before, it was that you weren't in a position to recognize hunger. And you know, your body, our bodies don't know, our brain does for sure, but our bodies don't know the reason behind why someone's not restricting. So the default conclusion is that there is no access to food. It just presumes that someone's in a famine, you know, we don't have food. So there is no point sending hunger signals to a brain that has no access to food, because as a survival mechanism, it's not particularly helpful to be feeling really hungry and not being able to respond to it. So your body's like, well, I'm just going to stop doing that because I'm not getting food in response to the hunger anyway. And I think with the drop in energy as well, that's also really challenging. But I think so many people describe feeling very high energy and having, you know, loads of energy to do stuff when they're restricting. But I would really challenge how much of that is just being in fight or flight and having very high adrenaline levels.
Absolutely.
You know, and then you've got, you know, energies being redirected to like digestion and away from like other parts mm-hmm. of your body. And that can often make us feel quite tired after eating, which is really normal. We're not supposed to have a super high increase in energy the moment we finish a meal. It doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. It's quite normal to feel quite tired after eating.
Yeah. And I think you're so right about kind of that energy level thing in terms of being in fight or flight mode. You know, like whenever I was doing anything, it felt like life or death. It was like, oh my God, I've got to do this. Like, you know, I'd be, I don't know, cleaning out my cat's litter box. It'd be like, oh my God, the world's going to end if I don't do this. I mean, it probably was going to because of the smell, but that's irrespective. But I think about the hunger as well, it's really interesting because, I mean, I before wasn't having like a mid-morning snack or a mid-afternoon snack. Like I'd have a small breakfast, small lunch, small dinner sort of thing. Now, we went to a property the other day and it was like 11 o'clock and I challenged my partner and I was like, genuinely, like, this is so intense right now. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether other people get this, but it's almost like my muscles like clamp up and I'm literally like frozen on the spot. I'm like, I actually like get all clammy and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and that feels so intense and overwhelming, like more hunger than I've ever felt in my life. And I'm just stood there like, this is so strange, because I'm definitely eating more and eating more variety and my body is getting more of what it needs, but then the kind of reaction to the hunger is so much more intense.
Yeah. And I often get clients that kind of, they compare how they experience hunger to, you know, others around them maybe don't have an eating disorder who can feel hungry and just kind of go about their day for a couple of hours before they respond to it, but it feels so urgent. And I think that's, you know, as well as the kind of physical things, I think when your body's being in a restrictive state, it's, you know, I think it almost sounds like a bit like a trauma response, in that you know, as soon as you feel hungry or like high levels of hunger, you know, all your body is presuming is like, oh, is this happening again? And I think that it sounds like a trauma response sometimes when people describe it, because restriction is such a loaded feeling, and therefore hunger is such a loaded feeling for someone that's been through such significant restriction. That makes sense.
No, that totally does. And actually, it makes sense why it's so intense. And my partner will always say to me, you're being so dramatic. You're just hungry. You're not going to die. We will find food. But it is so really overwhelming. But it makes sense, doesn't it? If your body has been deprived and in that restrictive state for so long, you know, I think, well, I'm now in a place where I never want to go back to where I was before, and my body is probably in the same place.
Exactly.
We don't want to go back.
Exactly.
There. So maybe the signs now are so much stronger because it is like, there is no possible way. And also we're really panicked that you are going to put us back in that situation.
Completely. And I think we often talk about, you know, needing to learn to trust your body again and that kind of process. But it's like it's a two-way relationship. And the process of recovery is also your body learning to trust you again and how you're going to, I guess, kind of treat your body, really. And that's something that takes time. And our body remembers things, you know, we hold things in our body.
Yeah. And I guess with that in mind, you know, you said it's the process of recovery is learning to trust yourself and your body. And I think that can be really difficult because, again, from my perspective, the reason I kind of, well, one of the reasons I think that the eating disorder was because I didn't have trust for my body and I felt very kind of against my body. And I suppose, yeah, people listening that are going through this period, what would be your advice for learning to trust your body again and to know that intense signal is something that you do actually need to respond to rather than just ignore?
Yeah, completely. I think for me, you know, obviously as a dietitian, one of the main things that I talk about at initial stages is there needing to be some kind of external plan. And now, you know, I don't mean something that's super rigid. I don't mean something that's got, you know, anything to do with calories whatsoever or super prescriptive. But I think there needs to be a period of that being dictated by something that is external so that you can start to relearn and retrust internal cues. Because otherwise it's just going from 0 to 100 and it's really, really hard. I think, you know, if you use the example, often people say, you know, they're never hungry in the morning. And usually what's happened is that there's been a restrictive behavior around skipping breakfast. And then the body learns not to expect food at that time. Most clients I worked with, once they put a breakfast in place, you know, after a few weeks, start to wake up feeling hungry. So sometimes it's putting the structure in to help to reestablish hunger cues. I think that, like, it sounds really silly, but I always use an example of needing to go to the toilet and like getting cues to like need a wee, basically. And no one ever questions that. No one says, maybe I don't need a wee, maybe I'm thirsty, or maybe I don't need a wee, maybe I need some fresh air. Like, it's just not a thing that you think of. I love using it as an example, but to some, but you know,
it's so silly.
Yeah, it's so, like, true.
I'm laughing because it's like, obviously when I need to go to the bathroom, I go to the bathroom. So why don't you listen to your hunger? And
completely. And that, like, our body, with everything, like, our body does not like to send us cues or signals unless it's like warranted. It's a waste of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to question. To stop questioning where the hunger is coming from. So I often get clients that will, they maybe feel hunger and then they'll start reading into it. So then all the questions come in. Why am I hungry today when I wasn't hungry yesterday? Why am I hungry when I just ate? Why am I hungry when I ate more than a week ago? Why? So I think trying to accept it as like a factual thing of, I'm feeling hungry, I need to eat. And then trying to quieting the noise around the overthinking is really, really helpful, I think. And I also think not using the word extreme also helps, because I think that can sometimes indicate that it's more complicated than it is in terms of how we respond to it. I think there's some stuff that might be helpful to talk about in terms of like emotional eating, and if there's a history of kind of binge eating, emotional eating, and that can create a lot of complexity around it, I think. But generally they're kind of tips that I would give somebody if they're struggling with responding to hunger, I guess.
Just before we go on to the emotional hunger, and also I want to come back to the term extreme, one thing that I wanted to ask in terms of what you were just talking about is, so I think having a hunger cue can be really overwhelming and difficult, especially if you've just eaten and you're like, why am I still hungry? Or if it's not maybe a time that you normally would eat, something like that, you know, if it's I remember messaging you the other day, like I had to wake up at 4 a.m. because I was so hungry. Like I felt really uncomfortable to eat something, but waking up because you're so hungry and not being able to have sleep sounds to me as though, you know, that's a sign to eat. I think one thing that I really struggled with is I almost could, the hunger cue is almost a validation of you are hungry right now, so eat. It's like, okay, I don't really want to, but my body's telling me that I should. When you first start recovering and you have a diet plan that you're supposed to be following, what are you supposed to do when, you know, it's breakfast, you've got your plan, but there's just no hunger cues there?
Okay, couple of things. If we're talking about particularly a restrictive eating disorder, and when I say a restrictive eating disorder, I mean any eating disorder where there are restrictive behaviours. I think it's important to, I always explain that you've got to be able to respond to hunger before you respond to fullness for a number of reasons. One is that fullness is always going to feel like a more negative feeling and emotion if you struggle with restriction. And then also you've kind of got the physical effects of restriction that can create early satiety and feeling full very quickly. So it's a risk to start responding to fullness too early. I think it's also, you know, when you've got thoughts going around in your head about whether it's, you know, your body image or whether you're worrying about how much you're eating or you're struggling with the challenges that you're facing, it's very, very easy for your eating disorder to convince you that you're full and you're not hungry. And trying to navigate and kind of work out what's actually going on there is really hard. So in that situation, I would always encourage somebody to stick with the plan and follow through with it. It's a different conversation at very, very late stages of recovery where, you know, at that point now, I'd be expecting to see kind of flexibility, you know, being able to eat outside the meal plan, having a 3-course meal out for dinner, you know, all of that kind of flexibility before going down the route of, oh, I don't actually feel hungry for that at the moment and that's okay.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think that I completely hear you on the whole, you know, your eating disorder will convince you that you're not hungry based on your body image, your mood and things like that. And I guess where it also comes in is, you know, like you said, that later down the line you're more flexible, and so that could mean that you spontaneously have a chocolate bar or you go out for your 3-course meal. So the flexibility means that you're eating more as well as sometimes less.
Exactly.
Whereas I think when you're at the start of it and you're just like, oh, I'm not hungry now, that's kind of always got that internal motivation of just wanting to eat less.
Yeah, completely. And I think, you know, I have lots of conversations with clients around it because it often comes up if we're talking about responding to hunger, and they'll often say kind of, if I have to respond to hunger, why can't I respond to fullness? And even that being a sentence, I think is interesting to explore in terms of why is there such desperation, I guess, for that. And that's, you know, telling me something there, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I always remember when, a few years back when I was doing okay, but definitely not kind of in a recovered place. And I always was like, do intuitive eating. And, you know, intuitive eating, when you're in a recovered place, is obviously that's great because that's how we should eat, you know, responding to hunger and fullness and stuff. But when you're in the depths of eating disorder or in the grasp of disordered eating, intuitive eating is just an excuse of restriction. And that definitely was for me. You know, I had this plan and I was like, I'm just going to eat intuitively. And, you know, it dropped down to barely nothing because you're like, oh well, I'm not hungry, so I'm not going to eat.
For sure.
And it's just dangerous,
definitely. And I think I also love talking about the fact that, you know, even someone that doesn't have an eating disorder eats like when they're not hungry all the time. I do it all the time. Like most people will eat with some kind of structure. You know, it gets to lunch, I don't question whether I'm hungry. It gets to lunchtime, I'm like, it's lunch. And that, I think that's more normal than people think. I think sometimes when you're in recovery, you can kind of like glamorize this idea of, you know, eating when you're hungry and not eating when you're full. Most people before they eat don't sit and try and establish, you know, how hungry or full they are. It's like, it's lunchtime, it's dinner time, it's breakfast to do with the afternoon picking up. Like that's usually what goes through people's brains. And I think that can be helpful in terms of, you know, helping people going through recovery not feeling so isolated in the experiences that they're going through. And actually, this isn't just a, you know, a recovery thing because you're going through recovery. it's actually also quite normal, you know, to sometimes eat when we're not hungry too.
Yeah. It's really interesting you say that because my partner, every day, he has lunch at 12. And that's because he works in a really big office and his team, they all go for lunch at 12. And I remember sort of saying to him one day, well, what happens if you're not hungry? He was like, what? I was like, well, what happens if you're not hungry at 12? And he was like, I don't know what you mean. I was like, well, if you're not hungry, then surely you don't want lunch. He was like, well, no, we go for lunch at 12 and it's the social act of having lunch together. It doesn't matter whether I'm hungry or not, because then I'm sustained and I've got the energy to go through the afternoon. Like, the point is that I have lunch with my colleagues. I'm not going to say, oh, guys, I'm not hungry yet. I'm going to go at one when then I've got no one to go with. Yeah. And I was like, sorry, what?
Yeah, yeah, 100%. That's such a good example of that. Such a good example of that. There's a really good example of actually where eating intuitively is like antisocial and rigid and not particularly normal.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it is, you know, that's something that I've been working on recently more so is, you know, not necessarily just eating when you're hungry, but like, you know, you go out for the day and there's a really nice looking bakery and you grab a pastry or something. Like, that doesn't have to be at a set time when you maybe have your snack, or like, it doesn't have to be that you're hungry for that. It's, you know, emotionally or, you know, being in the moment or something, that's why you're going to have it. And I think that I found to be the hardest part of recovery, because the almost functional eating, where you're like, well, I have to have my breakfast because that's on my plan, that was almost like, well, I have to do this for recovery. But it's almost now, I was actually saying this to my therapist the other day, in terms of like, when you go to a cafe for brunch, let's say, normally I would always have poached eggs on toast because it feels safe and it feels manageable. And I can do that now. I can go for brunch and have that. But I want to be able to have the French toast with berries and yogurt. But because functionally the poached eggs on toast is absolutely fine, nutritionally it's great, it would be that the French toast and yogurt and stuff would be something for me to enjoy rather than just be nutritionally beneficial.
Yes,
it's kind of that next step of allowing yourself to enjoy your food rather than just eating for fuel.
Yes, definitely. And I think it's always really interesting because most of the time if I do an assessment with somebody and we talk about their goals, the goals are, you know, maybe there's some goals around kind of functionality and physical health, etc. But the main goals that someone's, you know, very passionate about is, you know, I want to enjoy food, I want to be able to connect with people. And then it gets to it, and they're the things that feel really difficult. But I think it's so helpful to be asked, like, but why did you do this in the first place? Because, you know, maybe you knew weight recovery had to come with it, or maybe you knew that, you know, challenging the restriction had to come with it, but that wasn't, that probably wasn't why you stepped into recovery. And actually, I think that that's really helpful because they're the goals you had. And they're probably the goals you had when you, you know, when you stepped into recovery was, I want to be able to do those things. You know, in order to get to a place where you can connect socially, like, you have to make those choices, the ones that feel more difficult and, you know, aren't about food as fuel or, you know, nutrients, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. God, my cats are having a fight. And I think that's I find the hard part is actually then challenging that in terms of like actually going and doing it. You know, you can talk as much as you want about how scary it is and stuff, but those sorts of things that just come down to, you know, actually going to the restaurant, having what is quote unquote scary or what have you, and then kind of processing it afterwards and seeing what happens. But you also mentioned before emotional eating and kind of the role of hunger in that. And I just wondered what your thoughts around that were.
I think it's important to touch on, because I think when there is a history of emotional eating or overeating or binge eating, I think talking about extreme hunger or hunger, however you want to phrase it, by kind of saying like it's important you respond to it and lean into it, etc., when you've had those experiences, can feel really difficult and also maybe a little bit invalidating in terms of, okay, but I've also experienced significant distress around binge eating, so responding to hunger also feels really difficult, and so I think I quite like to talk through some actual like practical, I guess, signs of distinguishing emotional and physical hunger. just like checkpoints that people can kind of run through when they might be experiencing something like that. So, for example, with emotional eating, you might find that it's super sudden and you are like searching, or there's specific foods that you're thinking about or craving, as opposed to maybe there's a few different foods that can maybe satisfy this feeling. I'm not hyper focused on one type of food. You know, also I think, you know, time from last eaten can maybe be something to think about. But the most important thing I think is like emotional state. So I think emotion word wheels can be really helpful. You know, if you've noticed that your anxiety's got really high, or you've just had a distressing conversation or something like that has happened, and then all of a sudden you're thinking about food, that might be a sign that maybe there's something emotional going on. So these are things that are very specific to somebody that has a history of binge eating or emotional eating. Because I think that it can be, it's just another added layer to work through, I think. And this is why it's really important for it to be individualized, because I think, let me think about the best way to explain this. I think somebody who's had a restrictive eating disorder sometimes will bring up a fear of overeating or binge eating or eating, and having never engaged in binge eating before. And in those instances, I think that it can sometimes be a way of the eating disorder being like, no, this is a bad thing. You shouldn't respond to hunger because this might happen. And actually, that's not part, at the moment, that's not part of your experience. That's that you've never kind of experienced that before. Versus speaking to an individual who maybe that is part of their story and can be helpful to kind of talk through how to spot the differences, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess I've got two questions. I'm going to ask one first and ask the other. But for people that have experienced binge eating, if they get that kind of overwhelming intensity, maybe of like a very specific food, and they recognize this is an emotional response, what action should they take there? Should they just ignore it or eat the food, or what's the best thing to do?
So I would say if they recognize that it's coming from an emotional place, it's very nuanced, because I don't want to, I guess, shine a negative light on eating in response to emotions, because that is also very normal, mm-hmm. and part of normal eating. Mm-hmm. But I think through recovery, and if you're recovering from binge eating and emotional eating, there needs to be kind of like a, I guess, kind of like a pause, and then we reworking how to do that in a healthy way. So in those instances, I would say it's really helpful to have a toolbox. So, you know, as a dietitian, I'm not going to sit and say you shouldn't maybe lean towards that food because that might be coming from an emotional place and it might trigger a binge, and then give you zero tools and just say, okay, just to sit there and deal with it. That's super unhelpful. So actually, like, what are you going to do instead? Is it helpful to do some grounding things? Do you want to do some breathing? I think it's helpful to have a mix of kind of grounding activities, whether that's breathing, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 5 things you can see, 4 things, etc. And then having some practical things. So is it helpful to tidy your room? Is it helpful to go outside for 10 minutes and get some fresh air, take your dog on a walk, whatever it might be, and then reassess. So I think delay in time is really helpful, because often those urges happen really quickly. They don't stay up here for a super long time. And then if 20 minutes has gone past and actually you start maybe feeling some physical signs of hunger, you're thinking about having some other food and maybe not hyper fixated on the food that you've binged on before, is it time to have a snack? So that's kind of the process that I would encourage people to go through if that happens.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea, and I really like the idea of I think that's good with everything. When anything feels that really overwhelming intense, is to just kind of take a step back and pause. And I've been doing something similar recently, and I haven't actually shared this with anybody, because I think even though I'm really open about my recovery, there's still certain things that I'm like, oh my God, that's probably just me. I'm really embarrassed. However, I know that this podcast does help a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I shared something a little bit about it then, and quite a few people responded. But I got to a point where, especially if I was eating dinner on my own, I'd eat my dinner with a large portion of salad. to fill myself up. And then I think because I'd almost activated that we're eating button, mm-hmm. And the hunger button, I then was like ravenous. But I was like, no, you've had your portion of whatever dinner you should have. So I would just make myself an even bigger bowl of just salad. Mm-hmm. And I'd almost be not binging, because, you know, I don't think it would be called binging because it's not kind of the high calorie foods. But it was, you know, binging on salad. It was almost like, you know, completely out of control, like unaware of what I was doing, and then being like, oh, I've just eaten a whole bowl of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I then started doing, it took me a long time to recognise that I actually wasn't okay. And also the IBS symptom from that was ungodly. Yeah. So, you know, the next morning my stomach was so painful. I kind of said to myself, you need to stop this. So I now will eat my dinner, trying to have bigger portions.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I'm still hungry afterwards, I make myself a hot drink. And the process of having to boil the kettle, wait for the kettle to boil, make the cup of tea, feels like enough time to actually then take a step back and reassess, am I still hungry? Or was I just like in the cycle of binging on the vegetables afterwards? And sometimes I'm like, oh no, I am actually still hungry. So mm-hmm. I'll either, if there's a portion left over, I'll have some more, or kind of, you know, get a snack or dessert or whatever. And then other times it's like, oh no, I'm actually satiated right now. And then it's really nice to be like, huh, I did that, and I recognised that I'm satiated.
That's a really, really good tip. I often encourage a hot drink in the exact same way that you described it, in the sense of it's, you know, it's not a hot drink doing anything, but the process of
mm-hmm.
making something and sitting with it and drinking it slowly is just almost like reflection time, really. Before making a decision. And I think, you know, as you said, challenging the big portion of, you know, veg or salad that you're having with your dinner, and trying to, by challenging that, maybe upping the other nutrients portion to also mm-hmm. kind of caveat and help with the hunger in the first place is super, super helpful. That's something that can often really confuse hunger and fullness cues. It's like lots mm-hmm. of veg and salad, because physical fullness and satiation are just not the same thing at all, and that can be like an added layer of confusion, definitely.
Yeah, and I would get that. I'd be like, physically I'm so uncomfortable mm-hmm. right now, but mentally I'm still so hungry. But like, how can I possibly be hungry, because my body feels so full? And so then you're like, well, I can't possibly eat because physically I feel so uncomfortable, I must be full.
Yeah, completely. And you know, it's literally just about volume. And mm-hmm. if you drink loads of water in one go, physically you're probably going to feel quite full, your stomach might be a bit distended, but has that given your body any energy? No. So is it going to help mm-hmm. with actual satiation levels? Absolutely not. And it's the same with kind of not quite getting the balance of food groups right. I use a pizza as an example all the time, just because it's got all food groups on like one thing. And I often say, like, imagine if part of that was just removed. Like, imagine if you removed the base of the pizza, that is like having a meal with no carbohydrates, or just having, you know, carbohydrates, the base and the tomato on top with absolutely nothing else. You know, it's kind of like having no protein, no fat. So I think it's a helpful way to kind of explain to people that, you know, it might look like a proportion of food on your plate, but when you actually break it down, is it? And is that playing into mm-hmm. why you're not feeling properly satiated after you eat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And something else that I wanted to ask you, and it kind of links back to what my question was before about responding to hunger cues when they were maybe more emotional mm-hmm. in restriction. But I saw somebody put a post, I can't remember who it was now, but someone put a post on Instagram the other day, and it was like, even though I'd eaten a massive meal out with my parents, I was still meant to be hungry. Even though everyone else was full, I was still meant to be hungry. Yeah. I can't remember who it was, but it was a really good post, whoever it was. And basically my question was like, how much, and like, I think this is, again, arbitrary, mm-hmm. but I guess I'm just asking, it's more to be validated rather than anything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you have eaten and then you're mentally still hungry rather than physically hungry, is the right thing in that situation to lean into that? Or, you know, I think the balance is so hard, isn't it? Because I think it's, yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer, but it's just the balance is so hard.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'm always an advocate to my clients for leaning into things like that for a number of reasons. One is, I think it's so easy to forget once you're kind of like on the treadmill of recovery, you're going through the process, it's really easy to lose sight of what you put your body through. And so the expectation that your body then starts responding to food in the same way as other people does is completely illogical, because your body has been through things that other people's body hasn't. And I think, you know, if you kind of, I'm trying to think, I love an analogy. It's kind of like if you've got something that's, you know, really shifted on one side in terms of the restriction, and we're trying to like, you know, get back to normality, there's a process of it, you know, going up and down a little bit, you know, while we find like a norm. And part of recovery is trusting that process rather than trying to get back to the relationship you want with food as the end goal. That is not going to happen straight away. And I think it's okay that the way you feel after meals is not the same as people around you. It's okay if you go for a meal and everybody else is saying how full they are and unhelpful things like how could they possibly eat for days and nonsense like that. But you know, it's okay if you go home and you're like, I'm so hungry, I need to eat my nice snack. Because your experience is not the same as other people's. I think sometimes, as you know, as I've kind of said, if there is a risk or there's a history of binge eating, have a plan. You know, what are safe foods that you're not worried about binging? Like, can you eat with somebody? What's a safe environment for you to eat in that feels contained? There's ways around that. It definitely shouldn't ever be a no. That's the wrong thing to do. You shouldn't respond to that or. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've got an analogy for you. I thought of it when I was, because I think people always can give themselves so much more sympathy for physical injuries than for like mental health issues. So what I was thinking was recently one of my friends ruptured her ACL, and so you know she's going to have an operation, but she's not expecting that the day after the operation she can just walk again.
Yeah.
Like she's got a year's recovery basically. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing, I guess, for the eating disorder is, you know, if you've been in that restricted place for a long period of time, you can't just expect suddenly that your brain, neither of them are just going to be able to automatically be like, oh yeah, cool. We can act in a quote unquote normal way with food. I mean, what even
is
a normal like relationship with food? But I think one thing that kind of came into my head when you were talking was, I think one worry that I have, is that if I, you know, I've been so controlled and restrictive around what I've eaten, but there's now that concern that if I eat it, what if I can't stop? Like, you know, if I buy the tub of Ben and Jerry's, what if I do just eat the whole thing? If I eat the whole thing, then you can be in the whole thing. Yeah. But I think rationally I can think about that. But I think there is that worry of people like, you know, if I have Nutella in the house, what if I just can't stop eating the Nutella? And I think that for me has been the biggest thing of, okay, I want to lean into that much longer. I want to have the chocolate bar, but where my partner can eat a few squares of Tony's chocolate and be satisfied and feel a bit sick because it's so sweet. Mm-hmm. I can't stop.
I think the first thing I would think about is, are we talking about kind of theoretical fears, or are we talking about fear based on a reality for an individual, if that makes sense? Because I think approaching that has to be slightly different. Because, you know, if we're talking about, you know, in theory, the fear is that I've denied myself of these foods for so long that surely if I'm suddenly allowed them, I won't stop eating them. And the scarcity mindset that I kind of mentioned earlier, that those thoughts and feelings come from the fact that your body has been told over and over and over again, and your brain has been told over and over and over again, you're not allowed that. You know, it's the same as like telling a child not to touch something hot. Like, does that make sense? So it feels like...
Or when someone says... don't look over there.
Yeah.
And then you're like, all I want to do is look over there.
So that's why it feels like, but I'm never going to stop eating this food. And sometimes I will say to clients, if they're noticing like a real obsession with a certain type of food, you know, put it in the meal plan and have it every single day for a week and then see how you feel about it at the end. Mm-hmm. Probably quite over it at that point. And I think it's really powerful because it really takes the power away from the food. Because when you're in that place, it feels like food has so much power over you. So I think it's important to include those things. I think if there is a real worry of binging something, there are lots and lots of strategies. Trying things out of the house for the first time, or, you know, thinking about the package size that you're getting. Are there individual packets that feel a bit more contained? Can you try it with somebody for the first time? So there's definitely strategies to kind of get around the fear and start incorporating them. But I definitely would not allow the fear of, you know, losing control over something stopping you from going anywhere near it, because in the long term, it's not making the fear go anywhere at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a really good point, especially, you know, if it is something that you're worried about, there's nothing wrong about having it maybe a bit more contained than just kind of, you know, unleashing the beast, let's say. I don't think, you know, that doesn't have to come from a structured place. That can come from, you know, a place of you're wanting to enjoy what you're having and have a good relationship with it. And it makes me laugh because I remember a therapist that a few years ago, we were talking about Ben & Jerry's. That's always been a food that I like. I absolutely adore ice cream, but I do get worried if I have it in the house that I'll just kind of eat the whole thing. And I don't think Halo Top helps that, because that kind of encourages you to eat the whole thing.
For sure.
Anyway, I said to her, I was like, genuinely, if you put 10 tubs of Ben & Jerry's in front of me, I could eat them all. She was like, I don't think that you could eat 10 tubs of Ben & Jerry's. I was like, I could. Like, because in my mind, like, ice cream just melts into all the cracks, therefore it's not filling, and I'd be able to do it. She was like, okay, I want you to get 10 tubs of Ben & Jerry's, and I want you to eat them all. And, you know, I didn't do it, because if you think about the average price of Ben & Jerry's, about £5 tub. I do not have 60 quid to just spend when I was spending all the money on therapy. However, it did help me just rationalise, whilst you think that that's a concern, it probably isn't. And I think, like I said before to you, worst case scenario, you do eat the whole tub of Ben & Jerry's. Yeah. And let's just think about, okay, that might feel really uncomfortable in the moment. However, two things. One, you'll feel really uncomfortable, and then you can learn coping mechanisms for when you're uncomfortably full. Mm-hmm. Because that's another thing I said to my therapist, was I get such bad sensory issues from being too full, which is why I fear eating. Mm-hmm. And so I actually need to learn to be able to manage because sometimes I am going to feel a bit more full. And secondly, you do eat the whole tin of Ben & Jerry's, you realise the world hasn't ended. You can have Ben & Jerry's in the house, because you realise that actually it made you feel quite unwell having the whole thing, and you don't want to do that again.
Yeah.
So even that can be a learning experience if it does go that way.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's why it's, you know, I would always encourage to do the challenge to get the food, you know, and then think about strategies or maybe how to overcome things if they go a little bit wrong, having done that. Mm-hmm. If you kind of do that the other way around, you end up being so cautious, and mm-hmm. that might all be based on, you know, this theoretical fear that I'm going to eat 10 tubs of Ben & Jerry's. That's not actually a reality for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really trying to rationalize and to then almost have the reality. And I guess, just to finish up, we said at the start, we both said, oh, we're a bit unsure about the term extreme hunger. And I wanted to explore this with you, because I have been unsure about it, specifically from the angle that you said, you know, it makes it seem quite intense and bad and stuff like that. And then Live Label Free has written a book about extreme hunger. And I commented on the post to say, like, really interesting that you've written a book about this and stuff, but I'm not sure about the term extreme hunger. And then the eating disorder therapist replied, saying that if it was anything else, extreme pain or extreme weather or something like that, we wouldn't think badly of it. And it's almost because it's associated with hunger and diet culture that it's almost triggering to say extreme hunger, because you're like, I'm not extremely hungry. I'm just responding. So I thought that was a really interesting perspective.
That is really interesting. It's almost like, I guess, hunger, you know, whether we're meaning for it to be, has kind of been so adopted by diet culture to be be something, you know, to be wary of or avoidant of, or that then sticking the word extreme in front of it makes it seem super negative. Actually, as you said, you know, sticking the word extreme in front of other things wouldn't necessarily be thought of in that way. So maybe it's, you know, in a way, maybe it's about reclaiming the word hunger back from diet culture, is and seeing it as like a neutral word, I guess, rather than the assumption that it's negative.
Yeah, because I mean, I do still think that I don't like the term extreme hunger, because I don't think that when someone's going through recovery it is necessarily extreme. Like you said, I think it's just they've gone from a place of not acknowledging hunger to then acknowledging hunger, and it feels extreme. So I think that's why I don't like the phrase, because I think it's being misused. I don't think it actually is extreme, but I do also value the point of why do we necessarily think that's a bad thing because it's related to hunger. Because I think if you said, like, I don't know, extreme fatness rather than obese, I think that would be seen as a bad thing, because we associate fatness as being bad, which obviously isn't, but, you know, that's just how society is. It's almost like whichever word you put after it, the connotation with that means that it's either a good thing or a bad thing. Like, if I said extreme happiness, you wouldn't be like, don't say that.
That's so true. That's so true. It's really, no, I completely agree in terms of, you know, I don't think extreme hunger is extreme in terms of it being in response to, you know, your body responding to something it's been through. But that's such an interesting point in terms of like why it sometimes, you know, can feel like a triggering phrase, or that's coming more from the word hunger and how we view that as opposed to the extreme part of it, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I think we have sussed it. So that's so great to end the episode that way. It's been so lovely to chat to you, Beth, and thank you so much for sharing all of your insights and your expertise, because I think, you know, that's been really helpful for me to kind of get some tips on navigating different things. Where can people go to find out more about you and the work that you do?
You can go to @theeddietitian on Instagram, or my website's www.theeddietitian.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the afternoon, because I think it's going to be the last few days of sunshine.
I know. I might try and get outside and enjoy. I think it's autumn is upon us.
Which I do actually like.
So do I. I'm being dramatic.
Of the seasons. Right, good click.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.